Okay, so we're back with Ben Zoba having a fascinating conversation about where we are in today's world in terms of the money system that we're compelled to work with or through. And in our last conversation, Ben was talking about the ongoing strife and battles that have been waged to figure out the best way to have the money system operate in this society, and using the model of government-produced currency or private bank-produced currency. We are now in a situation where the private banks have won that contest, and we are all feeling the impact of that in some way or another. He also made mention of the fact that because it's in a private banking arrangement, the control over the money resides with a few. And in our last conversation, he said they're tricky. So I'm going to ask you now, Ben, what do you mean when you say they're tricky, and who are you talking about?
I was referring to the international banking cartel. And maybe one clear example of how they are tricky is now we look at our dollar. You called them greenbacks, but they are Federal Reserve notes. The dollar used to say this was a U.S. note, but now it's a Federal Reserve note. Most people, when they see that, they think, oh, okay, it's still the government. It has the term Federal Reserve. And that is part of the design. When the Federal Reserve was, before it was created, the banking moguls, J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, many European banking elite were involved, and they had a meeting at Jekyll Island.
What year was that meeting?
I think it was like 2 or 3 years before, so 1910 or somewhere around there. It's an island. They went there in secret. All the staff of the workers of the island were told to leave. The members took code names so that the media, you know, wouldn't be able to know that these guys were all getting together. Create a bill that put the power of money creation into private hands, but make it look like it's still federal, like it's still the government that's doing it.
I don't understand the thinking behind that. Why would they want to make it look like something other than what it was?
Well, if something goes wrong, which it inevitably would, if they can make it look like it's the government's.
What could go wrong?
Well, the Great Depression, for example. So this whole system was pitched to the people to prevent crazy fluctuations in the economy caused by bank runs, which are a function of fractional reserve lending, which we can get into later. But it was pitched to the people that stabilized the economy. 1913 was when it was created, and the Great Depression was not long after. And even still, people are confused about what the problem was. But when a small group has control over money creation, and this is an important cycle to understand, they can make loans lavish. They can lower the interest rate, make loans lavish, make credit easy so people can borrow. So in the 20s, the roaring 20s, people were borrowing because they could get real low interest loans, throw it in the stock market, get a higher percentage point on money that they just borrowed, and just make money off of money, which is attractive, but it's disastrous. It's not reality. You cannot get wealth without work. That's one of the key problems.
To back up a little bit, though, you said that they pitched it to the people so that it looked as if this was really a governmental structure and all that. Who pitched it, and how did they pitch it? What was the process through which it finally came into being that this was going to be the way we are going to do our money system?
Let me just finish the second part of that cycle that I started talking about, and then I'll answer that question. So the money powers, the ones managing the currency, can make credit lavish like they did in the 20s, but they can, on a whim or by design, depending on whatever their agendas are, they can make credit scarce. They can raise the interest rate, call in the loans, not create new money because money comes in the form of loans, as we learned. And so all of a sudden, because there's more debt than money out there, people are scrambling to pay off their loans. There's not new money coming into the system. And you get a situation like in the Great Depression where you had farmers with plenty of food that they wanted to sell, hungry people that wanted to buy the food, but there's no money to facilitate that transaction because the Federal Reserve shrank the money supply by 1/3. Now, if you think about money being like blood in your body, transport oxygen and carbon dioxide, amongst many other things, 1/3 of your blood was taken out, you're going to be depressed. And that's what happened. So that's the boom-bust cycle that they try to make it seem mysterious, but it's controlled, and we have no say on how they affect those rates and how they lend money.
So in other words, at some point they made their case, somehow this became appropriated, and thus we citizens, average Americans, are in their arena and we have no choice but to submit to their terms, and their terms are breaking the backs average people. But I do want to back up and understand how whoever this contingent of private bankers is, how they were able to make the case in a way that enabled this to become the standard and the accepted way of doing money.
People were very wary of what they called the money trust back then. You know, they probably started to see J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller kind of get monopolies and strong-arming themselves into having more and more control over the people. And so the people were very wary of the money trust. And, you know, after these guys met on Jekyll Island and eventually proposed the Federal Reserve Act, through their media outlets, J.P. Morgan came out acting like the Federal Reserve Act would crush the big banks, like this show. Oh no, don't pass this act, you know, it'll hurt big banking interests. And the people then, reading that and already wary of the money trust, got on board.
We haven't established what the money trust is yet. You said that people were wary of the money trust. What is the money trust?
It was basically the economic rulers of that time. You know, J.P. Morgan was a big player, and the Rockefellers, amongst others. So basically what we might call like the economic power elite.
How is that distinct from what eventually came to pass in the form of the Federal Reserve?
It's not. That's the point. They acted like they were against it to get the people for it. The law itself was passed right around Christmas when a lot of Congress people were away. So it was like a smallish group that voted it in. And
a small group of
Congress people.
Congress people.
Yeah.
You said they used their media outlets.
Mm-hmm.
Were they owners of newspapers or something? Was that, were those the media outlets?
Mm-hmm.
So help me understand then. They created a smokescreen of dissent from this. What was their hope that that would accomplish?
They wanted the Federal Reserve Act to be passed because that would put the power of money creation into their hands.
So, yeah, you said they were creating this, maybe I misheard you, but were they creating a smokescreen of protest about this for the sake of creating the impression that, that's confusing to me, whatever it was that you were saying.
People were against J.P. Morgan, the common man. They saw the power he was getting. So when he comes out saying that this bill would be bad for him, that it would actually control him and constrain him, which is what the people wanted, then they were more inclined to accept it. When really, you know, he wanted it passed because he knew it would give him and his buddies the unmatched power of controlling currency. There's a classic line attributed to Amschel Rothschild, a head of a banking family. He said, "Allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws." It's an old banking knowledge that if you control the money power, you know, the rest follows, basically.
Okay, well, there's a lot of, obviously, nuts and bolts in the historical evolution of how this came to pass. I think everybody recognizes that the Federal Reserve is the system that we are all subject to now. So I'm going to kind of fast forward, and there's still going to be other elements that we're going to have to address in upcoming podcasts. But given the fact that here we are, by whatever means, the system has been accepted, voted in, this is who we are. I mean, many of the presidential candidates and other political pundits and leaders have talked about challenging the Federal Reserve. So this, that there are people out there who feel it is not...
Traditionally, like the third party ones do.
Right.
You know, the main ones are all funded by the banks. The top contributors to Obama and Romney, the banks, the biggest banks.
Okay. Yeah. So it works well for whoever has a lot of money, but what's the impact that it's having on the day-to-day lives of average people? And this is where we come back to what we spoke about in the first podcast about living by the gospel principle. How is it impacting you and me and families and the elderly and students? What are we up against because of this system that was put in place in the early 1900s?
Well, for one, our wealth is being funneled upwards. The interest, what is actually usury, we call it interest, but the more technical term and related to religious conversations, I think especially relevant, is usury. But the usury that's associated with this system by design, takes the wealth, takes the energy, takes the man hours, the working hours from the people, from the workers, from the producers, from the average person, and funnels it up into the power of the financiers, the ones who can make money off of money because they can lend it at interest.
But how does that affect me today?
Well, interest affects everything we buy, you know, everything that is associated with money. Everything is way more expensive. Basically, it's twice as expensive. Even if you're not in debt paying interest, for you to go buy a laptop, that company at one point got loans to produce all those goods. You know, the person making the plastic for the keyboard got a loan. So there are very expensive capital costs involved in all that process that end up making things about twice as expensive as they need to be. So even look at like the house I mentioned. The $200,000 is for the house. Wood, the person who put all the love into putting all that together to build it, but I'm not paying $200,000, I'm paying $400,000. Mm-hmm. You know, the other $200,000 is for people who put in a few keystrokes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not producing anything. Mm-hmm. They're not adding anything to the economy. They're taking, mm-hmm. straight up taking. And so it's making everyone, you ask what it does to the families. Mm-hmm. Why is it that the father and the mother have to work now? I mean, we used to live in a time when only one parent had to work. And we since then have gained so much technology and learning and experience. You know, it's like we should be going in the opposite direction. We should be having more time for creative, productive leisure, for doing those things that are our own gifts to society, but more time to do art, more time to raise our families. It's a direct attack on the family, really. And if you're going to divide and conquer, the family is the first thing you need to divide. It's the most powerful unifier. And you can even witness a stable economy in a family. And they all serve each other. They don't need Federal Reserve notes for a parent to love a child and for the child to uphold the family and to serve the family. So that is one of the huge effects, the material effects, is that we are less wealthy. Our wealth is being sucked out of us by parasites, basically.
Okay, well, that's a grim picture, and probably most people recognize the level of struggle on such a basic level, and it's not getting better. People who should be creatively contributing to not only to the wealth of the economy, but to the culture of the economy, our backs are broken because they either don't have a job, they can't find a job, or if they have a job, it's all they can do to pay their bills. And there's nothing left in their human reservoir to be human. So I want to pick up on where Ben thinks this is going and what his idea for how people of faith or people who just believe in the principles that he's outlining can possibly find an alternative. So thanks for listening, and we'll look forward to our next conversation with Ben Zoba. This is Poets and Lunatics.